You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
Overall dynamic of the book of Exodus, as we start out each week in this series, is the movement from the forced service of building storehouses, that is Mishkanot, for Pharaoh in Egypt, to the willing service of constructing the Mishkan, the tabernacle for God at the foot of Mount Sinai. The problem with Egyptian slavery wasn't that Israel was forced to work, because we were created for work. The problem was that they were working on the wrong project, and they were working for the wrong master. So in the first panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered from service to Pharaoh, and in the second panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered for service to the Lord. And so the central theme of the book of Exodus is in many ways a tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build the city and tower of Babel on the backs of the oppressed with a covenantal promise to restore the garden sanctuary. So the book of Exodus has a prologue in verses 1 through 7 of the first chapter, and then you have two panels. Panel 1 goes from chapter 1 to chapter 13, and then panel 2 goes from chapter 14 through the end of the book. So you have these two panels, and both of them, it's like an old overhead projector where you have sort of the picture, and you can see the picture on the slide, but then the overhead projector makes it a little bit bigger and projects it up on the screen, so you can sort of see back how the same picture is being presented, but there's been somewhat of an expansion along the way. So you have a shorter initial section, and then you have a longer section, and what you can see is that they basically run over the same ground. There are echoes back and forth between these two different panels. And so in the first section of the first panel, you have Moses is delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. In the first section of the second panel, you have Israel is delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. In the second section of the first panel, you have the Lord appearing to Moses on the mountain of God and consecrating Moses as his messenger to Israel. And in the second section of the second panel, which is what we will, Lord willing, finish tonight, you have the Lord appearing to Israel on the mountain of God and consecrating Israel as his messenger to the nations. And it goes on through the five sections. And finally, it ends with the people being led by the fire and cloud at the end of chapter 13, and when you get to the end of chapter 40, you have another echo of the fire and the cloud and the people being led. So you sort of have the same arc. Now, there's different things that are happening. It's not identical. It's not a simple repetition, but you can see that the book has clearly been structured to set up this pattern. This is something that Moses clearly intended in the structuring of the book of Exodus. And so we've finished the first panel. And we are in the second panel. We finished the first section of the first panel, in which Israel is delivered through water and driven into the wilderness and brought to Mount Sinai. And now we come to the second section, which is where we've been for the past several weeks. And so in chapter 19, we have the covenant introduced. It recounts how God came down to meet with the children of Israel. It sets the stage for the covenant words in chapter 20 and the covenant judgments found in 21 through 23. The text is divided into these two categories of words and judgments. That's a header in the text itself. And as we'll see, some of the content in chapter 19 is closely parallel to the content in chapter 24. So this section, 19 through 24, which is really crucial, and even, Brother Ron, some of your question about the covenants, so many of the divisions between denominations among Christians really go back to what you do with 19 through 24 in the book of Exodus and how you relate this old covenant to the new covenant in the New Testament. So this really was a crucial section. So we slowed down just a little bit and spent some time digging into some of that. And if you look at this section as a whole, you see you have the introduction of the covenant in 19, and then you have the end of the covenant in 24, and there's some strong parallels in language, and then you have the actual covenant itself sandwiched in between those two. So you have a bit of our word that we've talked a lot about the past couple weeks, inclusio. We'll see that at a smaller level in our passage tonight, where you have an echo between the beginning and the end, and that sort of lets you know that you have wrapped the section out, especially in a book that would have been written without any chapter titles or headings or title pages or any of those things. These sorts of devices in the text are very important for determining the structure of a section or the book as a whole. Chapter 20, we have in 1 through 17, we have the 10 words or the 10 commandments. It's 10 words in Hebrew. And that's important because that words and judgments is how the text is divided. So seeing that you have the 10 words is helpful there. And so the remainder of chapter 20 provides a transition to the next major section in the text, which are the three chapters of specific judgments found in 21 through 23. So in chapter 21, verse 1 through 22:20, we saw legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations. We spent some time, had some fun with all the pushing oxen there, or at least I had some fun with the pushing oxen and the bailment of stolen stuff. And that was fun when we had all the kids in here, at least. Was fun for me. And then chapter 22:21 through 23:9, it moved from the legal wisdom exemplified in these situations to moral imperatives in every situation. So the imperatives of compassion and respect for authority and justice. And then 23 verses 10 through 19, we learned about the rhythms of life as illustrated by the festivals. And then the last section of the judgments is 23, 20 through 33. That's the one section we haven't dealt with, and we're going to deal with here in a few minutes. And that deals with the occupation of the land of Canaan. And then in chapter 24, after the judgments end at the end of 23, we find the formal ratification of the covenant. And that concludes this whole section. So we'll deal with chapter 24 here in a few minutes. And then it moves on to the rest of the book. So this is our last night, I think, as I mentioned, in Exodus for some time, because we have the graduation fellowship on the 12th, the 19th. We don't have a Sunday evening service. We have a members meeting on the 26th. Then we get into church on the lawn. So Lord willing, I'm not going to promise this. We'll see what happens. But September, we may do a mini series or something. But sometime in the fall, we'll pick back up and we'll learn about the construction of the tabernacle, which I'm really excited to be getting into for myself and also to be sharing with you, because there's a lot of really fascinating theological things in the tabernacle that I am just excited to be able to spend some time with. But this brings us, if we can finish 24, so we've got to finish this, this brings us to a really good stopping place at the end of the section, and we can pick up with the tabernacle later on in the year. So for now, though, we're in chapter 23 and verse 20, dealing with life in the land. Now, the previous section, the rhythms of life in 10 through 19, it dealt with the rhythms of settled life in the land and the feasts and the festivals that they would celebrate to honor those rhythms. And yet they are still camped in the wilderness. So God has given them instructions for what life in the land is going to look like, but they aren't in the land yet. They're still in the wilderness. And so this section that sort of is an epilogue, a conclusion to the book of the covenant, it provides some details on how they're going to get the land and how they're going to keep the land, because they can't have a settled life in the land if they don't have the land. So this is going to tell them about that. And throughout this section, we see promises and warnings alternate. So it goes between a promise and a promise and a warning, back and forth about life in the land. So Exodus 23 and verse 20. Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. Now, there are a good number of puzzles in this section. So we'll try to sort through some of them, though we won't be able to answer every question that could be raised. So in Hebrew, the word angel simply means messenger, and so the same word is used for human messengers and for divine messengers. The identity of these messengers, as we've seen as we've worked through Genesis, is often very ambiguous and mysterious, and that is certainly the case here. As elsewhere in the Old Testament, the angel or the angels of the Lord represent the Lord very closely without being completely identical with him. It's likely that we should distinguish between the angel referred to here and the angel of the Lord, who is so closely identified with Jesus that he seems at times to be a manifestation of the second person of the Trinity, the pre-incarnate Christ. In Exodus 33, after the rebellion with the golden calf, God distinguishes the work of this angel from his personal presence through the tabernacle. And an angel does show up several times in connection with the conquering of Canaan, just as God had promised. Each time we are met with the same sort of mystery, the same sort of ambiguity, with questions raised that the answers are not always given to. So in Joshua 5, as the children of Israel prepare to conquer Jericho, Joshua is met by the captain of the host of the Lord. It came to pass, Joshua 5:13, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, Art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place wherein thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. Is this talking about the angel that God promises to go before them? Or is this talking about the angel of the Lord is a distinct figure? Is it talking, who exactly is it talking about in Joshua 5? The text really doesn't tell us. What it tells us is that God promised he was going to send a messenger before them. And then we see this other figure showing up. Is it the same person? Well, Joshua bows down, so it would seem to be the angel of the Lord, and which is even more closely identified with the Lord than an angel of the Lord. There's puzzles. There's a little bit of ambiguity. It's a little clearer, though, in Judges 2, after they had failed to follow the instructions that God gave them and the warnings that God gave them in Exodus 23. And an angel of the Lord came from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I have made you to go up out of Egypt and have brought you unto the land which I swear unto your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and ye shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. Ye shall throw down their altars, but ye have not obeyed my voice. Why have ye done this? Wherefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your side, and their God shall be as a snare to you. So God said, I'm going to send an angel before you. He's going to drive out the inhabitants, but you have to be faithful to do the work of driving them out and not compromising with them. And then in Judges 2, an angel comes to them. God sends them an angel, and it's clear in Judges 2. The figure in Joshua 5 is ambiguous. I think it's probably more likely that we should see it as an appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ because Joshua is bowing down, though there is some ambiguity of what's going on there. But it's clear that the figure in Judges 2 is an angel, and it's labeled as an angel, and it's not called the angel of the Lord, but an angel of the Lord. So there's probably a connection between the person in Judges 2 and what God is promising here. And he says, I promised to drive out the inhabitants. I kept my promise, but you didn't keep my commandment. And so therefore, you're going to stumble into the altars that you didn't tear down, like this podium here. And there's much that's mysterious about angels. There's a lot that we don't know. There's a whole lot that we don't know about angels. And so we should not speculate over much and think that we know more than we actually do. At the same time, we should acknowledge the reality of angels, that Hebrews says that those who entertain strangers sometimes entertain angels unaware, that angels are at work in our midst. And I think because God talks about how he gives his angels charge over his children, that it's appropriate even to pray to God that he would send the protection of angels. It's a little bit funny how people will pray for a hedge of protection because usually, I looked up the word hedge, usually when God says he's going to send a hedge, it's not a good thing. It's a hedge of thorns to block up their way. So praying for a hedge is maybe not what you should do, but it would be appropriate to pray for God to protect, send his angels to take care of us and to protect us, recognizing we're praying to God, not to the angels. We're praying to God to protect us through his angels because that's something that he has promised to do. But at the same time, we shouldn't get into speculation that goes far beyond the scriptures. And we should simply trust what the text says and recognize there's a little bit of ambiguity that we don't always know exactly what's going on. But Hebrews does tell us that Christ is superior to all angels. And our confidence and our trust should be in him and not in angels. Verse 21, he goes on to give them instructions for how to deal with this messenger that would be sent before them. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. Now, the word that's translated as beware is the same word that's translated as keep in verse 20. So in verse 20, it says, Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way. So in Hebrew, the word that's translated as keep and the word that's translated as beware is exactly the same word. So the angel is going to keep them. The angel is going to pay attention to watch over them, and they're to watch over the angel. So they're to do the same thing. They're to pay attention to what the angel is instructing them about, to obey his voice, and then he is going to watch over them. Now, the end of verse 21 is a little bit puzzling, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. Given that the Lord's name is repeatedly associated with long-suffering and forgiveness, with graciousness, as we saw in our book just a few minutes ago, the last clause of this book is a bit puzzling. Some commentators have suggested that the word translated as for should it be rendered as something like although. They're both grammatical possibilities here in this context. And this seems to me likely to be right. So this would leave a translation like, "For he cannot forgive your offenses, even though he is my representative." So the point would therefore be that the forgiveness of sins is not the prerogative of this messenger. The forgiveness of sins belongs to God alone. So even though this messenger is very closely associated with God and bears the name of God and represents the presence of God to the people, he is not God. He is distinguished from the Lord himself. And so therefore they are to look to God for the forgiveness of sins and not to this angel. That could be what it's saying. It is a little bit puzzling, but that seems like it would give good sense, and certainly it would give good theological sense. Verse 22, "But if thou shalt indeed obey his voice," so he's given them a warning, pay attention to this angel that I'm sending before you, now he's going to give them a warning. "But if thou shalt indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto thine enemies and an adversary unto thine adversaries. For mine angel shall go before thee and bring thee unto the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off." So if they obey, if they pay attention to the instructions of the angel, then God is going to give them the land so that they can enter into the rhythms of life that have just been described in the previous verses that we talked about the last time. This, where it says, "I'll be an enemy unto thine enemies and an adversary unto thine adversaries," it surely must be alluding to the great promise made to Abraham in Genesis 12. "I'll bless them that bless thee and curse him that curses thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Even though different terms are used, there really seems to be an allusion between the two. Verse 24, "Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works." They're not to pay attention. They're not to do what the Canaanites are doing. "But thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images, and ye shall serve the Lord your God." They were not to participate in the idolatries of the nations of Canaan. They were not even to set up their images as trophies in a museum. So they weren't to say, "Okay, we've destroyed the Canaanites. Let's take their images and put them in a museum over here so we can see what God has done for us." They weren't even to do that. They were to destroy these images. They were to destroy the means by which the Canaanites had worshipped their gods. Without being too dogmatic, this perhaps should give at least some pause to the desire of some American Christians to find something, quote, redemptive in even the most vile of movies and other forms of entertainment. So there does seem to be a tendency on the part of some to, no matter how horrifically vile a show or a movie is, they're looking for something redemptive so we can somehow find something good so we can justify us watching it or participating in it. And that seems to be at tension with what God says here, that the things by which the wicked are worshiping their gods, you're not to try to find something redemptive or try to find something good with it. You're just to destroy it. So certainly God does give common grace, even to unbelievers. We learned about that just a few minutes ago. So that shouldn't necessarily be our attitude to everything that is out there in the world. But if there are things that are wicked and evil, there are times where destruction is the right approach. And we shouldn't be always so quick to try to find something redemptive in everything that is evil, but actually to sometimes we're called to hate what God hates and to seek its destruction. Of course, we're not to, you know, go out with the sword of slaughter as the old covenant people did, because God hasn't given the sword to us as he gave it to them. But in reference to our overall attitude to that which is wicked, I think this is still instructive to us today. "And he shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away." So there was a warning there. They're to destroy what the Canaanites used to worship their gods. And now he's going to give them another blessing. "He shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee. There shall nothing cast their young nor be barren in thy land. The number of thy days I will fulfill." If they pay attention to the Lord, he promised to bless them abundantly. We need to remember that though these particular blessings are part of the old covenant, a covenant that we are no longer under, our covenant, the new covenant, also has promises. Promises that if we are seeing according to the eyes of faith are far greater than those given to old covenant Israel. Hebrews 8:6, "But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises." In this covenant, we have the promise that God is working all things for the good of conforming us to the image of his Son. The promise that our faithful labors will be rewarded. The promise that our Lord will return for us. The promise of resurrection. The promise of the new heavens and the new earth. And many more promises besides. Sometimes we act as though we've gotten the short end of the stick, that we aren't guaranteed prosperity in the land if we're faithful to Jesus. But the promises that Jesus has made to us are better than the promises that were made in the Old Covenant, just as the mediator of the New Covenant is better than the mediator of the Old Covenant, just as Jesus is better than Moses. So the promises that God has given to us through Jesus are better than the promises that God has given to the Old Covenant people of God through Moses. And so we have not gotten the short end of the stick, even though it looks different. And sometimes we, in our short-sightedness, wish that we could just have a prosperous and peaceful life in the land. But what God has promised to us is better. Verse 27, I'll send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come. Now, the word that's translated as fear here only occurs twice in the book of Exodus. The other time is in the portion of the great song in Exodus 15, in which the conquest of the land is promised. The word that's translated as will destroy, so I'll send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come. It also occurs twice in Exodus, and it occurs in Exodus 14:24. It came to pass that in the morning, watch, the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians. And I didn't make a note of it, but I think it's the word that's troubled, that is the same as will destroy. But I didn't print the Hebrew text, so I can't double check that. But it's only in these two verses. And the point is that what God did to the Egyptian army in the Red Sea is what he's about to do to the Canaanites when they cross over the River Jordan. That's the point with that connection. And often in especially Hebrew literature, where you have a word that's only used in a couple of places, there are deliberate connections that are woven for using a word over here and using it over here. And often there's a significance to that, and there's a connection that's being set up. And I think that's the case here. And I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. So the literal Hebrew here is, I will give all your enemies to you neck. So it's difficult to know exactly how to translate this. The word oref refers to the back of the neck, and it's the same word that's used in the many references to being stiff-necked. So it's the nape of the neck. It's the back of your neck, like right here. So that's the word. So it's, I'm going to give all your enemies to you neck. Well, what's it saying? It's possible that the idea is they're going to turn tail and run. That's how the King James takes it, and a lot of English translations take it, that they're going to turn their back. So even though it's talking about neck, the idea is they've turned around, so you've got the back of the neck there, and that's the idea. There's another possibility, though, that the idea is their enemies are going to fall down and they're going to be standing on the back of their neck. So an English idiom that might capture that, we don't say have them by the scruff of the neck, but we might say have them by the throat. So they're going to be completely conquered. So maybe the idea would be like when Goliath falls down before David, and David is up on top of Goliath, and he's got his foot on his neck. He's conquered. He's subjugated. He can do nothing to resist. So the idea might be they're going to run away. The idea might be that they're going to be on their face with their foot on their neck. They're going to be completely destroyed. So either of those is a possibility, and there's a little bit of ambiguity. And I just sort of drew that out to illustrate that actually doing a completely literal translation is very difficult. There are often times where you've got idioms, you've got different things that are going on, and you've got to make a decision of what actually is going on in the text. So translation is always, to a certain degree, interpretive, and that's why there's a value in comparing multiple translations and seeing, even if you don't know Hebrew, not in a position to learn the biblical languages, you can get some of the benefit of that by comparing different translations and seeing where are the places where, like, all translations agree, it's probably pretty clear. Where are the places where you're having to make an interpretive decision, and maybe there's some ambiguity, or there's some ways to see it differently, and you can get some of the benefit of that by comparing translations. Verse 28, and I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before thee. Now, the word that's translated here as hornet is a bit mysterious. There's a lot of mysterious things in this section. There's a lot of questions that I wish I had better answers for, but it's good even to wrestle with the questions. It occurs two other times in the Hebrew Bible, both of them in exactly the same context. Once is a repetition of this promise in Deuteronomy, and once is a pointer to its fulfillment. Deuteronomy 7:20, moreover, the Lord thy God will send the hornet among them until they that are left and hide themselves from thee be destroyed. Joshua 24:12, and I sent the hornet before you, which drave them out from before you, even the two kings of the Amorites, but not with thy sword nor with thy bow. With just these three uses of the term, they're the only uses in the whole Hebrew Bible, We can't be exactly sure what it is referring to. As so often in these cases, our English word comes from the decision made by the translators of the Old Greek, who render it with a Greek word that means wasp or hornet. So a lot of times, when we don't know exactly what the Hebrew means, then the translators of the King James and other later English translations as well are going to follow what the Greek has if they know what the Greek word meant. So the only problem there is we actually have no way of knowing whether they were guessing like we're guessing or they had some inside information that we no longer have. It's very difficult to be sure of that. Now, there's one other thing. This is just that this rendering of it as a hornet or a wasp is supported by the later Hebrew of the rabbis, what's found in the Mishnah and the Talmud. But there's a whole other layer to this, and that is that the first language of some of the rabbis was Greek, and there were times when they clearly seemed to have used the Greek translation as a sort of dictionary the way that we would today. So there's the possibility of influence from the Greek back to the Hebrew of the rabbis, which means that there's a little bit of ambiguity with this. So other suggestions for what this word might mean could be something like terror, discouragement, or pestilence. And so whether it's speaking about a literal bug, like God sent a plague of hornets, there's nothing in the text that tells us about a plague of hornets. So it could be God did send like literal hornets who stung people and they ran away. That's possible. It could be that the word is referring to a hornet and it's symbolizing the terror that a swarm of hornets would inspire. If a swarm of hornets came in through that window right there, we would all be very terrorized if they were murder hornets, especially. We would not be happy. We would be looking for a way out and a way away from them. So it could be that it is speaking about a hornet, and it's symbolizing, but it's doing so in a symbolic way of the terror that hornets would inspire. Or it could be that the word simply refers to some sort of terror with no hornets being involved. Certainly we know that from the we'll get to there in a second. But despite the questions that we can't answer with certainty, and this is the reason I've sort of gone down this rabbit trail, so what exactly does this word mean? Like, to make a decision on that, there's all these sorts of evidences and there's all these questions that we can't be completely certain about. But we don't have to know exactly what the word means to get the point of the passage 3,500 years after it was written. The point of the passage remains completely clear, even while there are puzzles that we can devote our best efforts to. The point is that God is going to use his angel to terrorize the Canaanites so that they will be defeatable by the Israelites. And this is indeed what happened. Joshua 2:9. And she said unto the men, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. And so even though there are puzzles and there are questions, and we need to have a humility, both a humility about things we can't answer, and a willingness to actually put the work in to sift through some questions that can be very complex. But we must not get so lost in those weeds that we miss what we can see clearly in the text, even in any English translation of this passage. Verse 29, I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased and inherit the land. So Joshua makes clear that while no active resistance remained, they didn't conquer the whole land in the first wave of conquest. This passage is echoed in Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 7:22. And the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee. Verse 31, I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines. So from the Mediterranean Sea on the west, to the Straits of, my brain's going blank. The Red Sea is the Straits of Gulf of Aqaba. That's what I'm thinking of. The Gulf of Aqaba on the west. So that's going to be their western border. The Gulf of Aqaba is going to be their western border. And then it says from the from the desert, that is, that'll be their southern boundary. So the desert that's in Arabia is going to be their southern boundary, and the river. So you, some English translations bring this out explicitly, but pretty much whenever you see the river in the Old Testament, it's referring to the river Euphrates. So you'll be from the Euphrates to the desert, from the Mediterranean to the Gulf of Aqaba. Those are going to be the boundaries of the people. That would have been the boundaries of the people of God had they been faithful. And it seems as though in the days of Solomon and David, this was fulfilled for a brief time. It's a little bit, some disagree on that because they didn't necessarily all inhabit that area, but they fell under David and Solomon's political dominance at that point. But in any case, God has now expanded the bounds of the land for his people to include not just from the Mediterranean to the Gulf of Aqaba or from the desert to the river Euphrates, but to include the whole earth. The meek, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, will inherit not just the land of Canaan, but the earth in its entirety, and the earth, not only its entirety, but the earth made entirely new. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. So in this passage, we've been told that the hornets are going to drive out the inhabitants of the land. Verse 28, whatever that's referring to, the hornets, the fear, something. Something is going to drive them out, maybe the... And then we're told in verse 29 that God himself is going to drive them out. And then in verse 31, we're told that the Israelites are going to drive the inhabitants of the land out. God works through men and through means. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. This is a very important point. As God fulfills his promises, he calls us to trust in him, to be thankful for the means that he uses to accomplish his promises, and to be at work ourselves. All three of those are important, and all three of those take place at the same time. He calls us to put forth effort ourselves to acknowledge the means he has chosen to use while trusting that everything is under the providential control of God himself without denying the reality of men or means. So in the matter of our health is in the hands of the Lord, and yet we are called to put forth effort to take care of our health, and also to thank the Lord for the good doctors that he may send to accomplish his care for our health. So we give out all the praise to God. We trust in his sovereignty. We also get to work, and we also thank him for the means that he chooses to use to accomplish his purposes. Verse 32, thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it shall surely be a snare unto thee. So we just had in verse 31, we just had a blessing. And then in verses 32 through 33, it ends on a note of warning, a final warning, one they would ignore to their peril. And so verse 33 brings the book of the covenant to a conclusion. And now we come to the ratification in chapter 24, which parallels the introduction in chapter 19. But before we move on to the ratification of the covenant, are there any questions on the ground that we just covered? Can't take a huge amount of time, but just any questions right now. All right. Brother Chad.
I just had a comment on the angels, studying the angels. I find it fascinating that there's times where men fall down at the feet of angels. And I was reading in Revelation where John falls down. And there's a delineation when it says, like in Revelation, John falls down to worship, and the angel rebukes him of doing
that. Right.
There's other times where, like, Balaam falls down at the feet of the angel, but it doesn't say he worships the angel, and the angel doesn't stop him from doing so, from falling down.
Right.
Same thing with Manoah. When Manoah goes to sacrifice, he says, okay, but sacrifice to the Lord.
Right.
And so it is interesting, in Abraham also, the same thing, falling down, and they don't rebuke him from doing that, the three visitors, right? So it's interesting in Scripture how there is a delineation between certain angels that may be the Lord,
yeah,
and other angels. And part of it seems to be the way they respond to worship and the act of men.
Yeah, there is that. There is one other layer to that, and that is that the word for bowing down and the word for worship are sometimes the same. Mm. So sometimes you've got I think the reality that you're pointing to is right, but sometimes you have an ambiguity of translation that you almost have to decide what's taking place to know how to translate it to make. So it's like that delineation is real. That's why, so like my instincts would be to see Joshua 5 as like the angel of the Lord, a pre-incarnate Christ. But because you have those places where it's clear it's not Christ and they're bowing down and they're not rebuked, then simply because there's that bowing down and it's not rebuked in Joshua 5, doesn't necessarily remove every layer of ambiguity from it. But I think you're on the right track. It's just like, you have like, even in, this really comes to the fore, like in the narrative of Hagar, where it's like the angel is speaking, but then the Lord is speaking, but then the angel is speaking, and it goes back and forth. And it's like, there's this phrase, I didn't put it in my notes, but I've used it before from a commentator, about how there's this like inherent ambiguity about speaking, about how we're hearing from God, the divine is relating to the human, that there's a mystery about it. And almost like the language that's going back and forth is trying to communicate the fact that it probably wasn't completely clear to Hagar what was going on, or to Jacob what was going on, that there's a mysteriousness to it, that we can't sort of put God in a box. We know we can affirm certain theological things that are absolutely true, but there's always this amount that's outside of our comprehension, outside of our control, how exactly God is doing this. And so I think that's, you know, and it just gets into this where sometimes we just have to say, God's God, he uses angels, and we just have to trust him. But I think you're on the right track with that idea. And certainly that's clear in Revelation. But in the Old Testament, it's almost like you have this mystery, and then, you know, Christ comes, and he's the final revelation. And the distinction between Christ and the angels is very clear. You know, Hebrews makes it so clear. Revelation makes it so clear. Yeah. But that clarity that we have now, we shouldn't read that back into those stories in the Old Testament. And so that's where you get some of that puzzlement. But I think that comment is on the right track for sure. All right, anyone else? Okay, chapter 24. So in the first part of this chapter, verses 1 through 11, we get the ratification ceremony for the covenant. And in the second part, we get Moses once more called up the mountain to receive stone tablets with the covenant and additional instructions for how to live in covenant with God. So the actual ratification of the covenant itself is in verses 1 through 11. As so often in Exodus, we have an inclusio. First, the leaders are told to go up the mountain. Then we have the ratification ceremony with the nation as a whole. And then we have a description of the leader's trip up the mountain. So 24 and verse 1. Pardon me. He said unto Moses, come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with him. So it's important to note there are three zones on Mount Sinai. So you have the people that are gathered around the mountain, and the people have been sanctified. They have had to be sanctified by Moses. The people are in a holy condition as they are around the mountain. So even around the mountain, to a certain degree, is a holy place. And then you have the elders and the other leaders of the people of God that are the representatives of the people of God that kind of go halfway up the mountain. And then you have Moses alone who goes to the glory cloud on the top of the mountain. Is that reminding you of anything? Anyone? Tabernacle? What are the three zones in the tabernacle? Yeah, you have the courts and the holy place and the holy of holies. So you have these three. So the people are allowed to come into the court. The representatives of the people go into the holy place. And the high priest alone goes into the holy of holies. We're going to see this. I am so excited to get into this when we get back to the book of Exodus later on in the year, that the tabernacle is a portable Mount Sinai. So this glory cloud, very significant, the glory cloud's on top of the mountain, and at the end of the book, the glory cloud has come off of Mount Sinai and entered off of the top of Mount Sinai and entered into the Holy of Holies. And so there's all these connections between the Garden of Eden, Mount Sinai, and the tabernacle. If we ever get to Leviticus, there's so many. The book of Leviticus is actually structured. The literary structure of the book of Exodus is patterned after the architectural structure of the tabernacle, which is patterned after the geographical structure of Mount Sinai, which is an image of the structure of Eden in Genesis. There are just all these connections that are going back and forth. And, of course, the Holy of Holies, there are cherubim that are on the veil. Well, where did the cherubim show up before? They're guarding the entrance to Eden. So the Holy of Holies in the Garden of Eden have a connection back and forth. There's just all these things. I'm excited to get into that. But right now we're in Exodus 24. So after these instructions in the first two verses, the actual ratification ceremony is described in verses 3 through 8. In order to see how tight the relationship between 19, 3 through 8 and 24, 3 through 8 is, it'd be helpful to reread the verses from chapter 19 at this point. Moses went up unto God, and God, this is from chapter 19, and God called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. So that phrase, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, shows up in 19, and we're going to see it repeated over and over again, or at least twice, here in chapter 24, verse 3. So Moses came. So you see the echo that Moses received the offer of the covenant, and then he went and told the people about it, and the people accepted it. Now Moses has received the wording of the covenant. He's going to go and tell the people about it, and the people are going to accept it. You see that parallel between the two sections. Verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. Now, as we've mentioned several times, the book of the covenant in chapters 20 through 23 is divided into the words, that is the Ten Commandments, and the judgments, that is chapters 21 through 23. The beginning of chapter 21, it says, these are the judgments. So we have this division into words and judgments. And now the people have heard the words of God from heaven, the Ten Commandments, but the people were afraid to hear any more from God off the mountain. And so Moses has heard, and now Moses is going to communicate the judgments to the people. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. In any case, as they had promised at the beginning, the children of Israel once again promised to do all that the Lord has said, so they freely agreed to the conditions of the covenant. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and rose up early in the morning, and builded an altar under the hill, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. So Moses puts the covenant in writing. He's heard it from God. Now he's told it to the people. Now he writes it down. He puts the covenant in writing, and then he makes preparations. He sets up these 12, he builds an altar, presumably according to the instructions were given at the end of Exodus 20, and he sets up 12 pillars that represent the 12 tribes. Verse 5, so it's the next morning, and they're going to finish the ratification of the covenant. He sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. So the young men are likely representatives of the people as a whole. They needed to be young men rather than the elders themselves because slaughtering oxen is pretty intensive labor. So if the elders of the people probably weren't up to the task of slaughtering that many oxen. And there's two different offerings that the oxen were offered as. The burnt offerings were wholly consumed on the altar. And then the peace offerings, a representative portion would be consumed on the altar, with the bulk of the animal being eaten by the worshipers. So whenever you have the peace offerings offered, it's a meal. It's a covenant ratification meal that is taking place. And so the covenant ratification will involve a meal. Verse 6, Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And so he takes the blood from the oxen, he puts some of it in, he puts it in bowls, and he takes half the blood, he dumps it on the altar, and he sets the other half aside. And then again, he reads the conditions of the covenant. Verse 7, he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. So Moses has come, he's told the people what God has said, he's written it down, now he reads it to them again. He's letting them know what God has said so that there's no secret clauses to this covenant. The people are going to be aware of what God has said. They know what they're getting themselves in for. So he reads out what he has written. And they said, all that the Lord has said we will do and be obedient. So this is now the third time that the people have freely agreed to the covenant. Verse 8, and Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people. Now, given the size of the nation of Israel, it seems most likely, a lot of people have suggested this, that the 12 pillars were set up as a representation of the people so that he splashes the blood on the 12 pillars representing the 12 tribes rather than having the whole nation pass before him. It seems unlikely there would have been quite enough blood for that and or enough time to carry out an operation like that. Of course, that's possible, but it seems that that may have been the purpose of the pillars, to represent the people just as the altar represented the presence of the Lord. I wouldn't want to be too dogmatic on that, but that seems, at least to me, to make sense. And he said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words. Half the blood has now been put on the altar, representing God, and half on the pillars, I think, representing the people. And while some aspects of this remain mysterious, it seems to be a kinship-making ceremony, with the closest analogy being that of a wedding. Jeremiah, in fact, explicitly describes the Old Covenant in terms of a marriage covenant. Imagery picked up in several of the other prophets as well. Jeremiah 31, 32, "Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them." And that's an image you find all throughout the prophets of God as a husband unto Israel. And this seems to be the ceremony that initiates that relationship. "Behold the blood of the covenant." It's important to note that the word covenant and testament in Greek are the same. And in Greek, the word that is used here in Exodus, in the old Greek of Exodus, is the exact same word that Jesus uses at the Last Supper. Covenant, testament, diatheke, to describe the making of the new covenant. Luke chapter 22, verse 20. "Likewise also the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new testament or the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." Now here's something I never noticed before, and I wouldn't want to go to town too much on this, but it seemed really neat to me at least. Paul refers to the first apostles, that is James, Peter, and John in the book of Galatians, I think it is. He refers to them as what? Those who seem to be pillars. Where do we find pillars? Here in Exodus. Who is there at the Last Supper when Jesus says, this is the blood of the new covenant? God. Well, God is there, but the 12 apostles, who are the pillars. And so just as Moses set up 12 pillars to represent the people and shared a bowl of the blood of the covenant between the altar and those pillars, so also did Jesus. He called 12 pillars as the foundation stones of his people and shared the cup of the new covenant in his blood with them when he instituted the Lord's Supper. So just as the blood of the covenant sacrifice was shared between the altar and the pillars, so when Jesus takes the cup and he drinks of it and he tells them to drink of it, he's sharing the cup, he's sharing the blood of the covenant with them. So there seems to be a connection that is going on there. Last comment on this verse concerning all these words. A more literal translation of the Hebrew here would be in addition to all of these words. Rather than that the covenant is about all these words, the point is that the Lord has made his covenant with Israel. This is a quote from a commentator, both by means of the words of the covenant and by means of a covenant ritual of blood. So there are words in the covenant that have been written down, and those words are important, and there also is a ritual. There's a ceremony involving blood, and those two together are how the covenant is made. In other words, we have the same pairing of word and sacrament, or word and ordinance in the Old Covenant that we have in the New Testament, in the New Covenant. Baptism and the Lord's Supper are not a nice add-in like an Easter pageant or some drama that we might think would be nice to observe. Though they must never be separated from the Word of God, Word and sacrament go together as though the water and the wine and the bread had magical power on their own. When combined with the Word, they're absolutely foundational to what it means to be the gathered people of God. And so we have the agreement of the covenant in verses 3 through 8, and then in verses 9 through 11, we have the leaders going up. "Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, as it were the body of heaven in his clearness." Now, here's something really cool. Remember I said all these parallels between what they were doing for Pharaoh and what God wanted them to do? So the word that's translated as paved work is exactly the same word that is used for the bricks they made for Pharaoh back in Egypt. They went from building mud bricks without straw for Pharaoh to seeing a pavement of bricks under the feet of the Lord. So there's bricks in both cases. The word that's translated as sapphire in the King James and many other English translations is almost certainly not what we call a sapphire today. One of the things that is interesting is there become certain traditions of how things... So an interesting example of this is bronze. So the King James talks about brass, and a lot of later English translations talk about bronze. But what actually happened is what we call brass today is an invention that took place after the King James was translated. And so bronze was a word that was invented later on, to refer to what used to be called brass, because what used to be called, because the new thing took on the name of brass. So even in how things are classified over time, how minerals or metals get their names or different alloys, there's a shift in how we use terms. And so most of sort of the technical terms for even precious stones, how we define precious stones, a lot of that classification system comes later on. And so we're trying to figure out how to map stuff up when maybe they had a different way of referring to things back then. So the stone that we call a sapphire today seems not to have been known in the ancient Near East. It's known by the New Testament times, but it, according to archaeologists and those who know about such things, I'm not an expert personally on it, sapphires weren't used in the ancient Near East. But what was used is what we call today lapis lazuli. Lapis lazuli is a semi-precious stone that is deep blue and has what looks like gold streaks in it. And one translator rendered it this way: under his feet, there was what looked like a lapis lazuli tile, and it sparkled like heaven itself. We find this same description in Ezekiel, and above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne as the appearance of a sapphire stone, and the same word is used, and it probably is referring to lapis lazuli as well. Upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above it. Does a deep blue thing remind you of anything in the tabernacle? What is deep blue in the tabernacle? The veil. The veil is blue, and it has, what's it have on it? It has cherubim. Now, the text doesn't actually tell us that the cherubim are made of gold, though it would seem fitting that they were. So it tells us that you have the ephod of the high priest is actually deep blue streaked with gold. And it may be that the same was true of the veil, but the veil is certainly deep blue. And so it's like they're halfway up the tabernacle, they're in the holy place, and they're looking up, and they see something that looks like really deep blue. So it's like Sinai is like the tabernacle. If we take the tabernacle and we put it up like this, we get Sinai. They get to the holy place, they look up, and they see the veil that is under the throne of God, which, of course, the cherubim over the ark of the holy place is what is beyond the veil. So they don't actually see the face of God. Moses, in later on, I think in chapter 33 and 34, is still looking to see God's face. So they haven't seen it because Moses is there with them. But they see a vision of the glory of God. And it's like they're looking up and they see the blue of the veil. Thou shalt make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen of cunning work. With cherubims shall it be made. Verse 11, and upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand. Also they saw God and did eat and drink. So as part of the covenant-making ceremony, the representatives of God's people had a meal in his presence. And the Lord's Supper is a renewal of our covenant with God and also a foretaste of the marriage feast that is to consummate our covenant with him. It's deeply rooted in the Old Testament, and it's drawing on so many themes from Exodus and really all throughout the Scriptures. So after completing this ceremony with the people down at the foot of Mount Sinai and with the leaders of the people halfway up Mount Sinai, Moses is summoned up to the top of the mountain to receive the official and permanent copy of the covenant. So we have words being delivered to the people. Moses hears the words, he delivers them. Moses writes the words down, and he reads them, and the people agree to it. Now that the covenant has been agreed to, he's going to receive an official copy on a permanent surface. So this is actually very much in keeping with covenant or treaty making in the ancient Near East, that you'd have your copies that would go back and forth. You've agreed to it, and now you're going to set it in stone. Put it in writing, then you set it in stone. So this is one of the reasons that we have a lot of covenant documents from the ancient Near East, is they would be written on stone somewhere. They'd be put on something permanent so that there would be access to them. And it would not be able to be changed. Verse 12. The Lord said unto Moses, come up to me into the mount and be there, and I'll give thee tables of stone and a law and commandments which I have written that thou mayest teach them. And Moses rose up and his minister Joshua, and Joshua was sort of Moses' assistant, and Moses went up unto the mountain of God, and he said unto the elders, tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, let him come unto them. So Aaron and Hur are left in charge while Moses goes up to receive the permanent copy of the law and also to receive instructions for the construction of the tabernacle. And so Aaron and Hur are left in charge. That's why when the people want to build the golden calf, they go to Aaron and Hur because they've been left in charge. Verse 15, Moses went up into the mount and a cloud covered the mount, and the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day called he Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So Moses is up on the mountain. So the elders go back down the mountain. All the people go back down the mountain. They're down with the people. Moses is halfway up the mountain with Joshua, but he's not at the summit. He waits 6 days, and on the seventh day, he's going to go up to the top. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. And so this sets the stage for the next section of the book, which is the revelation regarding the tabernacle in 25 through 31. At the end of this, at the end of chapter 31, God gives Moses two stone tablets with the official copy of the covenant that has been cut between the people and God. And it's likely when it says he gives him the two tablets, we probably shouldn't be thinking of something's written on this tablet and something's written on that tablet. But when a covenant was cut between two kingdoms, there would be two copies made, a copy for the one party to the treaty and a copy for the other party to the treaty. But in the tabernacle, most likely, it seems it's saying there were two copies, God's copy and the people's copy. But because God was with the people, they were both kept in the same place, namely the Ark of the Covenant. And yet, at the end of 31, when Moses goes down the covenant, something isn't right. And we will be getting into all of that later on. We have a few minutes for questions if anyone has any questions. And if not, we will be done. And we'll be done with Exodus for a while, but I am already looking forward to getting back into it. Any questions before you wrap up? Over here? James. Any questions or comments as well?
Just regarding that point that you pointed out about how the blue and the curtain and the veil kind of harkens back to Psalm 11, Psalm 103, and Psalm 104, where it says he has set he has established his throne in the heavens and has set his throne on the heavens.
Oh, that's really cool.
Three times in Psalm 11, 103, and
yeah, that's really neat.
It's just you bringing that through, thought it was kind of interesting.
That is really interesting. Thank you for pointing that out. I appreciate that. Sarah. Because that's the language that's used in Ezekiel, too, of like this movable heavens and sky. It's really quite remarkable. Sarah.
This might be kind of a weird question, but when Moses was in the mountains for 40 days and 40 nights, is there any significance to the fact that that's the same amount of time that Noah and his family was in the ark?
Did it rain for 40 days and 40 nights?
The flood.
Yeah, there's a pattern of 40 days and 40 nights, really. You have that with Elijah as well. You have that shows up. I don't have it at the tip of my memory, but you have this sort of recurring pattern of 40 days and 40 nights that goes all throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament as well. So I can't think off the top of my head of like what connection to make, but there's certainly a significance. It's a significant period of time that shows up repeatedly and sort of serves as a connection to these different episodes. So yeah, I don't have like what the significance was, but it certainly links. And sometimes even some of those numbers and that sort of thing, it's not like there's some always a mysterious significance to the number, but it's just the, like with words, it's not like there's some magic to the particular word, but just that it links different things together and helps us to see things in parallel and helps us to see the echoes of one to the other. So that, in some cases, it's not even so much that there's something, you know, super special about 40 as opposed to 39, just that there is something significant about the link between the two that goes. The craziest of all of those is, for me, the 42 stages of the children of Israel through the wilderness paired with the 42 generations leading up to Jesus. And you can see how Matthew has deliberately left some generations out. He's clearly working to come up with that particular number. And then you look at all the other themes, and it really seems to me like he's done that intentionally to make that super subtle connection, which fits perfectly with the broader themes that are right there on the surface. So you see all these kinds of echoes, and it's really pretty cool.
thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.